This podcast is brought to you by Viva Global. Experience the difference with Viva. You are listening to FNR Football Nation Radio.
Nation Radio, and you're listening to If You Know Your History with Ian Sison and Paul Mavroudis. What did I just say? I had a Donald Trump moment there.
Did
Paul Mavroudis.
Yes.
Yeah. How are you today, Paul?
Disoriented.
Why is that?
Because they've moved our seats around.
Yeah, but they have, and now we've got an Australian shirt in the background, the near background.
I don't know where I am at the moment. Yeah, let's just figure it out.
Yeah, it is very confusing.
Shall we get started?
Yes, we shall. We shall. We've got some cleaning up to do, Paul.
Yeah, we always have something to clean up a bit. One of the interesting things I saw this week on Twitter, a very interesting place, is an Australian rules historian, Rhett Bartlett.
Yep. Is he related to Kevin Bartlett?
It's his son.
Okay.
Some funny moments there too, but that's another story. You know, he's particularly interested in the Richmond Football Club for obvious reasons to our Victorian and et cetera listeners. And recently he's announced that there are certain publications, I think in the Richmond area, from 1910 thereabouts, have been put up on Trove, and they're up on Trove because he self-funded it.
Yes,
and I mean that's commendable.
I went straight in and searched for soccer and British Association football in that newspaper for that time period, and I found about 12 references. So I've completely drained it already.
Already?
Yeah.
It's done?
Yeah. It's remarkable how few references are. And two of those references were to the Prahran soccer, football, cricketers club. So there you go.
I mean, this is a very commendable thing that he's done.
Yeah, absolutely.
But it's also very foolhardy in some ways as well, isn't it?
Because he's providing an example of a user pays mentality.
Yeah.
When really the knowledge should be democratic. It should be available to everybody. But you know, to be fair, he has made it available to everybody.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, this is not. This is not a bad thing that he's done in the sense that deliberately. Yeah, no, he's advertised it. Yeah. It's there for everybody, and he's not recommending people do this. Mm. I mean, there's obviously stuff that he's wanted to find there, and he's done it.
Yeah.
But it's not a really sustainable model, is it?
No. I mean, it's one way Trove could function a bit better, and you know, given how hard they're being come down on, they're being
by the government cutbacks and so forth. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. So.
Because there was a while there where Trove was actually progressing quite a lot of papers, and then it stopped because the funding got cut to the National Library. No cuts to the ABC, SBS, et cetera, et cetera. But, I mean, it does make you think at least provisionally about things like, you know, searching for grants and maybe starting Kickstarters, and how would you prioritise the things you wanted to find?
Well, I'd get the Mount Isa papers done.
You would.
Yeah.
So, good on Rhett for doing that. I mean, it's almost a bit sad that it's come to this, that someone has to do it themselves. Yeah. And it is, and we know it's a very expensive thing to do because it does cost a lot of money to scan those materials.
He may have spent upward $10,000 on that.
I wouldn't even want to know. At one point I heard it was maybe like $2 a page, not in this case and another case, but I'm not sure the numbers.
Yeah. Anyway, we'll be guessing. And what else? What else has come up, Paul?
We got some feedback on our Celtic segment.
Dear.
A bit of a chiding, in a friendly way. I mean, this is what we want. We want the listeners to correct us and get back to us. And we had a bit of a playful go at the writer Celtic.
Yeah, well, we speculated that he was just fresh off the boat.
And I think that was mostly you doing that.
Yeah, I was doing that. He was fresh off the boat and didn't understand the culture he was talking about properly. And
our New South Wales listeners, who are usually pretty quiet. Mm-hmm. Got in touch with us. And first of all, Greg Stock, you know,
great man,
New South Wales soccer historian, sent this message. Celtic was the pen name of Sid Grant when writing in the newspapers and soccer publications at the time. He's not a traditional historian or statistician, but someone who saw the need to keep records and did the best that he could. He also wrote the Jack Pollard soccer book as well. And we thank Greg for that information. But then Trevor Thompson also chimed in.
Another great man,
another New South Wales soccer historian, at least inadvertently. He was not a newbie. He was Sid Grant, prominent New South Wales and national official for over 30 years. He was probably the most prominent football writer in the North for the Cessnock Eagle, Newcastle Sun and Newcastle Herald. He was part of the group which effectively took over the national organisation in the early 30s. He was an avid collector of info and memorabilia. When he died, his collection passed to Harry Hetherington. I went to Harry's house, once in Cessnock, and saw a collection that filled his garage and the spare room. His wife insisted this could not go on. The collection moved to the Northern New South Wales headquarters to the specially designated Harry Hetherington room. I think info was digitised and is held by Newcastle Library. In the 70s, Jack Pollard's soccer records became, I would say, the first popularly available record of Australian soccer history. It was all Grant's work.
So this doesn't explain, though, why they would make that, why he would make that mistake. Why would someone with so much knowledge about the game in Australia make a mistake of, you know, the mistake we identified was not understanding that promotion relegation had existed in other parts of Australia 30 years before this time.
But Trevor goes on to explain the reason for that.
Oh, right.
Yes.
You like the way I did that?
No, not really. You ruined the surprise. Like all of us, his work has shortcomings, but he is still, for my money, a real football history pioneer. As for his knowledge of promotion, etc., it would be pretty hard to know about other states' arrangements, especially in the case of New South Wales, which, yes, because it was such overwhelmingly the dominant soccer state.
But I'm not convinced because of that still. But there must be another explanation, because whilst he's in Cessnock or in Newcastle, wherever he is, that's not far from Sydney. He would know the situation in Sydney.
Yes, but I think there is a validity to Trevor's claim about New South Wales so far ahead, they just would pay no heed.
Yeah, that's right. So there's a certain sort of sarcasm in that assertion.
To a certain extent. Yeah. And I think it taps into modern disagreements in a certain other sport called fumbleball.
Yeah.
About record keeping and whose records matter and so forth. And one of the assertions I made is that, well, because people make the assertion, well, why isn't the AFL, for instance, take into account Western Australian, South Australian, records and titles?
Because
and so
exactly the same reason, it's not important.
Because the AFL is the Victorian competition, and the Victorians do not care.
Yep.
And it's interesting to see these things play out over a number of different sports in very similar kind of ways.
Yeah. Well, and as they might. Well, look, that's great. We've tidied that up. I don't think there's anything else we need to tidy up, is there?
Only one more thing on that. I mean, there's stuff about Sid Grant in towards the end of Phil Mosley's book.
Yeah.
Terrific book. Maybe I'll read it one day.
Yep.
Where it talks about Sid Grant and his MBE and his legacy and all the things he controlled and contributed, and he's a great man.
Yeah.
But the issue of pseudonyms is important as well, and we have to recognise that there's an issue that so many football journalists at the time in the early half of the 20th century and even a little bit beyond that wrote in pseudonyms.
Mm.
And that makes it very difficult. And I spoke to Mark Borich about this last week on the way to Dandenong or Endeavour Hills, and he said he had a list of the Victorian soccer writers and the pseudonyms. And maybe that's one of the first things, even before we do your inventory,
we've
got to find out who they actually
were.
Well,
it's part of the inventory anyway.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay.
Moving on?
Well, we'll move on, and we'll move on to my favourite session of the segment of the week, and that's 100 years ago today. Can you get an echo happening there in future? Can you turn echo on and 100 years ago today? Last
today,
week.
Today.
Yeah, that sort of thing. Last week we previewed a game between Toowoomba, the combined Toowoomba team and the Eleanor team, and you said you would be very excited to find out who won the game.
And I should have been more specific on air during the show.
I did tweet it, but for those people who didn't see my tweet, the game, Toowoomba got out to a 3-1 lead, and they were pulled back by the Eleanor team from Milton, and they ended up a 3-3 draw, a six-goal thriller. Is that what they call it?
Yeah.
And interestingly, it opens up by saying both teams were weakened owing to the prevailing epidemic. Nevertheless, an excellent exhibition of soccer resulted. So
I'm just not feeling it now because you ruined
it. I'll stop it.
And because, you know, I grew up in the early 90s when you're watching, like, say, the footy replay and whatever, or, you know, the footy live game, and then say, we're going to show this game later. If you don't want to know the scores, look away now.
Okay, well, I'm going to be reading out about Melbourne soon, and I won't tell the scores until next week.
That'd be good, yeah. Okay. And if we can play, you know, like right on the tip of my tongue by Diesel, that'd be good too.
And this article on the game, which is quite long, and it's up on the website, it reveals something really quite interesting to me, that Toowoomba at this stage has 16 competing school teams in one competition, and that seems to me to be a lot.
That's a lot of schools.
That's a lot of schools. I mean, it is a school town.
Is it?
Yeah, it's a lot of private schools.
Oh, okay.
And so they're playing soccer, and it's interesting. Anyway, look, I'll move on because we've got a lot to get through today. Now again, it's the 6th of June, 1919.
Not May 6th.
No, not May 6th. And let's move to Winoona. Where's Winoona?
It's in Wollongong.
Wollongong, yes.
I've watched RBT a lot, yeah. And they seem to travel around there.
And this is Soccer by Observer. So it's a match report.
Another pseudonymous person.
Yeah, Observer. Players in the interdistrict game on Saturday last at Winoona were unable to show the fine points of the game owing to the condition of the ground, which was in a very bad state in spite of the amount of work expended on it by the local enthusiasts, who bailed hard for a couple of hours. Seating. I love the language of this. It's like just so unfamiliar to current use. Seating accommodation was provided for the ladies who turned up in large numbers. The crowd that witnessed these games was the largest gathering ever seen at a football match in this district, with the exception of the New Zealand game some years ago, which shows the popularity of soccer in this end of the district. This game was of special importance from the players' point of view, knowing the selection committee were on the ground for the purpose of selecting the best 11 players from amongst them to meet the Sydney district team on the 9th of June. No doubt the spectators had their full money's worth. Some amusing incidents happened during both games, which brought roars of laughter from a good-natured crowd. The Bulleye Band, which is composed of real sports, gave their services free, which was much appreciated by everyone. The Quoit match. It was a Quoit match before.
So they're still playing Quoits in
1919. Which took place on the ground was interesting from start to finish. It was won by Chapman. Conspicuous on the ground were young ladies selling Peace Carnival raffle tickets. After they would have had a carnival after the war had finished. There, you know,
and if you haven't died from the flu yet.
Yeah. who seemed to be doing a roaring trade. The sport opened with the game between Kiraville and Thirroul. Thirroul is an interesting place, isn't it, Paul?
It's very interesting.
Why?
You tell me. You're the one who, you know, is fascinated by Thirroul. Death.
Well, Thirroul's one of those beautiful northern Wollongong suburbs. It's just a fabulous coastline. It's a really beautiful space. I might say that because it's the first place I lived in Australia.
I think I saw that place on RBT as well.
Yeah. Well, Thirroul was the place where Brett Whiteley, the Australian artist, died of a drug overdose. But perhaps more famously, it's where D.H. Lawrence lived when he wrote his novel Kangaroo.
Does anyone know who D.H. Lawrence is anymore?
D.H. Lawrence, Lady Chatterley's Lover, Women in Love, Wrestling by
the Fire.
Nobody
reads anymore.
Yeah, I know.
People are watching Black Mirror and things like that, right?
After an exciting and hard struggle, Kiraville won. Kiraville will knock very hard for the medals in the third grade competition, and so on and so on. It's just it's a terrific report. It's really personable. Again, it's one of those reports that says, soccer belongs here. It's part of the community.
And what's important about these things, it gets the sense of the carnival atmosphere that was very common in a lot of different sports, a lot of different things. So you might have had different bands and a sport and all these people, different parts of the community getting together to do these fundraisers. And you're right, soccer is part of it here. Yep. In other parts of New South Wales, maybe in Sydney, it might have been a different sport.
Yeah, that's right. But let's move to Melbourne now. Because we'll go to the place where it's certainly not like that.
Mm.
This is right at the end of a big, long article on football, all the codes of football that are played in Melbourne on that weekend. And this is British Association. The following matches will be played – oh, no, sorry, it's a preview – will be played tomorrow under soccer rules. And the games are Footscray Thistle versus Spotswood, Albert Park versus St David's A, Melbourne Thistle versus Preston, St David's versus Windsor. So we've got four ethnic teams in that little mix, eight teams, four ethnic teams, two Welsh and two Scottish. So that's.
I wonder if the Welsh Church in Melbourne still has records of all these things.
Wow.
Because they actually have the Welsh language services as well. But anyway, that's a diversion. Yeah.
It gives the team lists for a couple of the teams and also advertises a match between North and South will be played at Spotswood on the King's birthday, which is just around the corner.
So north of England or north of the river?
No, north of Melbourne, I think.
Mm.
Yeah. I assume it's north of Melbourne, South Melbourne, because the South team will be selected at Middle Park on the conclusion of tomorrow's games.
Makes sense.
Yeah, okay. All right. I was going to read out about soccer balls, but you won't let me, so I'll just...
I'm not banning. You can do whatever you like. It's your show.
it's our show.
I'm here for comic relief.
Yeah, you are. Well, I just found in Brisbane in 1919, they were advertising cowhide soccer footballs for 15 and 6, match balls for 15 and 6, and that's about $60 in today's terms. But there was also Basel soccer footballs, and I think I know what they are. Basil tanning makes the leather darker as it tans because of the herbs that's in the tanning process. And so, you know those really dark-coloured footballs you see?
Uh-huh.
They're basil tanned.
So there's artisanal soccer balls.
Yeah. And I don't care. I mean, imagine whatever they were, they would get soaked when they were wet and really hard to kick. So
just can't imagine these hipster soccer balls in 1919. You can't just have a regular soccer ball. You've got to have it infused with herbs.
Now, okay, well, I'll move on. That's advertised in the Brisbane paper. So we've got $60 soccer balls or 15 and 6 soccer
balls. That's a lot of money.
Yeah, and the rugby balls in the same advertisement were $23 shillings.
Is that because they weren't being kicked as often?
That's a bit bigger.
Mm.
But I would have thought a round ball, a spherical ball, was harder to make than an ovoid ball.
Possibly.
Yeah.
Any ball makers out there can let us know.
Maybe it needs more leather. I don't know.
I'm not sure.
Yeah. Anyway, and look, just because we're going a little bit quicker than I thought we would. When I go up at 6 o'clock this morning, this is my practice. I get up and I go straight to the computer and I look at the 100 years ago today, and I typed in the 6th of May. Right, so I did a whole hour's work finding out the 6th of May details, and then I realised it was the 6th of June. So I'd wasted all that time. However, I did find one that I really have to read out from Football at Jervis Bay, and it was in the Sun in Sydney. And it's about code war. It's about code problems between codes. Jervis Bay is the naval college, and when you think of naval college, you think of, you know, junior officers studying. But these kids are actually between 13 and 18.
Mm.
And some of the first graduating group ended up going into the war because they kicked off at around 1913. They graduated and then onto ships during the war. And so I'll read the report. Information having reached the league. Now, the league in this is the Victorian Football League, the VFL, that the Australian game was not getting a fair deal at Jervis Bay. A deputation from that body was appointed to interview the responsible minister on the subject. The statement was made that the English officers would not permit the Australian game to be played. A similar state of affairs existed not so many years ago in the schools of West Australia. But the local league, headed by the indefatigable, that's a great word, indefatigable, Mr. J.J. Simons, saw the Minister of Education, who made it compulsory for all codes, Australian rugby and soccer, to be placed on an equality. Letting the boys decide, the result was satisfactory. So that's really interesting. Here's an argument that being made by the VFL that all codes should be treated equally.
Mm. Or they think that if their footy is available as a choice, that'll win.
Yeah. All codes should be treated equally, but only in states where they're not dominant.
Yes.
Okay. So it's an interesting little moment in the history of code war. And the kind of the shoes on the other foot there for footy, I think, because usually they're in a position of dominance.
Yeah, and I think when they're in a position of dominance, that it's all across all classes, across all strata of society, where they fail to make inroads into thing. They fail to make inroads into working class society and middle class, upper middle class society in Sydney and Queensland, for instance. It's kind of interesting. Yeah. What they take for granted in Melbourne, for instance, just doesn't work.
Yeah.
Nobody really cares as much.
Yep.
It's not part of the cultural makeup. Hmm. How do people relate to this? I mean, this is the kind of interesting thing because when you read, I mean, like I've read some stuff this week about rugby league was popular with working class because it was imbued with working class values.
Yeah.
Rugby union, again, similar kind of thing because it had middle class, upper middle class values. That's why it appealed to that particular audience. Why? What's Australian rules appeal to people outside of its immediate demographic? And I think this is one of the things they probably struggle to figure out or don't understand.
Wasn't what Australian rules had that it didn't have a particular demographic.
And maybe that's very makes it very strong in Melbourne.
Yeah, it makes it very strong.
But I mean,
I often equate Australian rules with rugby in New Zealand. Because rugby union in New Zealand has the same cross-class, cross-race.
And this is maybe where soccer struggles because it doesn't fit into those clear demographics.
Well,
except in pockets.
Soccer is in some pockets a very middle-class game in Australia, and other pockets it's a particular kind of working-class game. Maybe like we talked before about the artisan working class.
People with working class who had steady jobs.
Yeah, yeah.
As opposed to sort of itinerant kind of labourers.
Yeah. So a middle-class Protestant game. Let's upper middle-class, upper working-class, middle-class Protestant game.
Yeah.
And it's a big section of society, but it's not big enough to provide a great critical mass.
And it's not big enough, it's not clear enough demographically.
Yeah.
Whereas being working class in Australia at the lower end was very much a clear social aspect.
Yeah. And especially with Catholicism rolled into it as well.
Yeah.
If you're a working class Catholic in Sydney, you're a rugby league supporter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, time for a break?
Yeah, time for a break.
You're listening to If You Know Your History on FNR Football Nation Radio with Paul Mavroudis and Ian Sison. And Ian, we have a guest?
I think we do. Do we have a guest there?
We do.
Oh, who are you?
Greg. I'm Greg. Greg Downs. How are you, Ian? How are you, Paul?
I'm very good, Greg.
I'm fine. You don't sound as imposing from this distance.
No?
No.
Your main claim to fame is that you've scored a try on the SCG, isn't it?
That's correct.
Yeah,
no one was there to see it, but
But you definitely scored a try on there. So that impresses the billio out of me.
Does it?
Yeah.
No, I wish I would have been there last night to score a few tries, but there you go.
Was there a game on last night?
Yeah.
Not at the SCG. Yeah.
Not at the SCG. No.
Anyway, you're here to talk about something very different from rugby league, aren't you?
I am. Yes, I'm here to talk about women's international football.
Yes.
Leading up to the Women's World Cup, which begins this weekend.
Yeah, are you excited about the World Cup, Greg?
I am, actually.
I'm starting to feel a bit of a tingle.
Come on. I think it's going to be probably, in terms of media and following and, social media and all the rest of the biggest one ever. With the Australian team going so well, and all the punters saying that we could definitely make it into the group of 16 possibly quarterfinals on the semi finals. It's very exciting.
Yeah, you're just breaking up there a bit, Greg.
Sorry, mate.
Can we do something about that?
You got me?
Yeah.
We got you, but just a bit echoey.
Yeah, you were just going in and out a bit.
Okay.
Yeah.
No, you're fine now.
Yeah, it's good
now.
So this build-up, Greg, can you compare it to sort of previous World Cups that you're sort of familiar with and how it's changed over time?
I haven't been associated with too many, but the last one in Canada was this one now. It's leaps and bounds ahead in terms of people being involved in the wider.
What's happened? There's been this massive shift in the whole framework of professional sport, and it's like women have entered the consciousness of the media and administrators in a phenomenal way. I think what's happened in Australia with all of the football codes catching up to soccer in some ways in terms of promotion and media focus. But, soccer's going on from strength to strength as well. So what on earth has produced that?
Well, that's a good, very good question, Ian. But I think a lot of it comes down to, success breeds that kind of public and commercial appeal to. Yeah. Like the Matildas have been, over the last, half a dozen years, progressively becoming more, winning more games, becoming more prominent in the public arena, media have, you know, cottoned on to the bandwagon and, you know, noticing that women's sport is not as bad as everyone thinks it might be. You know, we're getting role models, you're getting recognition of players, you know, they're getting, money's coming into the game. If you're looking at the different sports, even with cricket, you know, like women's remuneration packages and their pay parities are still nowhere near the men's, but certainly a lot better than what it was, and enabling a lot of these women to play professionally rather than what they were doing previously. Sponsorship then comes into play. And all those sort of issues.
So you used the phrase there, what it was, which is, you know, a great pointer to what we're interested in, which is what it was, what, you know, the history of the game. And so, I mean, we're suggesting that, you know, massive changes occurred. And so let's work backwards then. Let's work backwards. I mean, you know, where does the story start for you?
Well, for me, internationally, Australia, if you're talking about Australia, we weren't involved internationally until 1975. And that wasn't even a national team. We were invited. Yep. That was just after the inauguration of the Australian Women's Soccer Association in 1974. And we were invited to play in the Asian Cup in Hong Kong under the Asian Ladies Football Confederation, which is kind of ironic, really, because if you think about it, because the Australian women were playing within Asia, under the Asian Ladies Football Confederation way back in the 70s, before we officially went there into the AFC in 2006. But in saying that, they played a number of internationals, starting, you know, a New South Wales team was sent in 1975 in that inaugural invitation to the Asian Cup. And then from then on, we started to progress and were invited to more international games. However, the first international that was officially recognised wasn't until 1979 when we played that competition against New Zealand.
Right.
Which I spoke to you earlier about in the Trans-Tasman Cup, and there was that Rose Bowl trophy, which no one seems to know where it is.
It's sitting there with the ashes somewhere.
Somewhere, that's right. Another trophy that's
one more trophy.
Supposedly there, but not.
Yeah. So, Greg, how did the women's teams fund their trips? I mean, these are probably very expensive.
Well, they had to fund themselves. The Australian government provided little in financial support. And it's interesting to note that one of our first international competitions was a women's invitation tournament in Taiwan. The Australian government refused to provide any support for teams that were associated with either South Africa or Taiwan due to political issues. And the Republic of China Football Association come on board and funded all of the nation's airfares and internal costs just to ensure that the tournament went ahead. So that was the first time they'd ever received any kind of financial support for travel and, associated costs when they were overseas.
And they had to get it from a rogue nation.
A rogue nation, China, that's right. And I think the Football Association was very keen at that point to make sure the tournament succeeded.
Yeah.
So they were probably politically motivated as well.
How far back does the Asian Ladies Association go?
1968.
Right, okay. So it's not much older, but a little older.
No, but it was consumed into the AFC in the 1980s, I think.
So thinking in deeper historical sense, I mean, where do we go back to find the first rumblings of international women's football?
Well, I mean, you have to probably go back to Greg Brooke, to England back in the early, or the late 1800s.
Yeah.
They talk about teams or clubs that were representing either England or Scotland playing in games in the late 1800s. And there was reference to even a team from Ireland playing England in the early 1900s. Okay. Then, of course, you go into the First World War and where the women's game internationally picked up because of the teams that were playing for, you know, in munitions factories and such while the men were at war. and there were a number of games between England and France during that time. So we go way back to the late 1800s, early 1900s.
But it flattens, doesn't it? After the war, you've got that sort of outpouring in all over the place. You've got this outpouring of soccer and other codes in the early 20s, say, but then it kind of flattens.
It flattened over in England too because of the ban, the FA ban in 1921. And although competitions still do play, they couldn't play on associated pitches. And and the men come back, took the jobs back and the game and started playing the game again. So the women's game was, I suppose, sidelined a little.
That perennial problem of access to grounds is something I'll talk about later as well, but it also applies to the development of women's football.
So, I mean, that went on for 50 years, I think it was, officially was thwarted.
So, Greg, I mean, to go back forward in time to the Australian women's teams, were there selection issues? I mean, it was probably difficult enough to get the money to go overseas. It must have been really expensive just to go interstate to do the selection trials and interstate tournaments. Were there sort of state biases? I mean, say towards New South Wales or Queensland, which tend to be the stronger female football states.
I don't know. I think the majority of players would have come from there, but I'm only going from what I've gleaned from talking to some of the players. I mean, they used to pay for their own travel, and were playing. Well, even when they represented Australia, they were playing in hand-me-down Australian men's tracksuits, and they had to sew their own emblems on their jackets, and that's how bad it was. I don't know about any bias.
I mean, was it harder for a Western Australian player to get into the national team than, say, someone from the ACT?
I'd say so, because of the expense, and they wouldn't be able to travel. If they couldn't raise the money to travel, they wouldn't be selected.
I mean, that's the nature of these kinds of fledgling kind of sports. I mean, at a certain point, you have to make inordinate sacrifices to even be considered to play if you come from a remote area or an area that's remote from the centre of power or the strongest states, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, that still goes on today. I mean, even if you're a regional athlete, it's more difficult to find your pathway rather than if you're in the city. But you're right. I mean, a lot of these women first had to get over the hardships of playing the game, and then if they went on to represent, they then had to either rely on families to fund or communities to fund, through fundraising and Lamington drives and raffles and all the rest of it, just to raise money for them to get to the national championships wherever they were held.
Greg, we've in our usual kind of panic of organisation, we've probably ended up organising too much tonight. So we're going to have to cut the time down soon. But there's a few things that I'd like you to comment on.
Yes.
The first is, are we going to win?
Honestly, I don't think so.
Yeah.
I think if I've had a look at the, I've tried to study the draw and possibilities if we come first or second in our group, and I think we should come first in our group. And if we come first in our group, we in the round of 16 we play a third or a team that's come third, one of the four thirds, which is okay. Which is good, which possibly leads us into the quarterfinals. But if we get to the quarterfinals, we're either going to play, I reckon, someone like England or the Netherlands. And not to say that we can't beat those teams, but they're going to be they're really top tier teams.
Who's going to win then?
Oh, I really don't know.
Yeah. It does seem to me, and I'm no expert, but it seems to me there'd be a broad field.
You just want something to bet on, don't you?
Yeah.
I don't think it's going to be the United States.
Yeah.
I don't think it's going to be Japan, but I think it might be a European side. I think it might be Germany, might be France, could even be England, might be us. You never know. But if I was being honest, I would think semi-final would be a really, really
the
good
second line of betting.
Yeah, really, really good result.
Now,
for
one more thing, Greg.
Yes.
What's happening with your book?
What about my book?
Yeah, is it coming out? What's happening with it?
I've only just organised it, and I'm still working on an agreeable name for the title with Benita. But I'm looking at.
So it's going with Benita.
Yes.
With
Fair Play
Publishing.
Yeah. Oh, you remember the title now this time.
Sorry. Yeah. So
it's going to be about the pioneers of the game. It's going to be about dedicated lives, stories of the pioneers.
Having read it already, mate, it's going to be a brilliant book. And
can you declare the conflict of interest here?
I don't see the conflict of interest.
Just say you were a supervisor.
I supervised his PhD at the university, all right? Okay, so that's...
So do you remember it, Ian?
Wasn't it about scoring a try at the SCG? No.
I couldn't, no.
No, it's a terrific oral history of...
I found it useful for my own research. Yeah.
So can people, remember Greg's name, Greg Downs, and it will come out with Fair Play Publishing sometime next year?
Hopefully, Ian.
Okay.
Might be at the Writers' Festival, mate. You might have to come down again.
Okay, well, look, thanks a lot, Greg. And sorry to
get no worries. Thanks for the invite.
No, not a problem. And we'll see you soon, mate.
Thanks, Paul. Nice talking to you.
See ya.
All right. Football Nation Radio, and you're listening to If You Know Your History with Ian Syson and Paul Mavroudis. And we're going to resurrect something that we tried to do before Christmas, which I thought we'd do much more of, which was sacred sites. But I'm using it sort of ironically.
Well, this is when you want it to be more organised than you actually could possibly ever be. You want it to, segment everything to be very neat clean and whatever. It's not going to happen.
No, it's not. And I've called this one called Grounds for Discontent, and it's up on my website. So if you want to have a look at this, you want to track it down via my Twitter feed, you'll find it. During the last week, I was part of an unpleasant moment on soccer Twitter. There was a pile-on against an individual who had objected to the new Melbourne Victory Complex in Footscray Park next to Victoria University. And I sent a tweet to the person suggesting that you'd have a little more credibility on this issue if you weren't such a hardcore footy fan. I checked your timeline for sporting references, and soccer doesn't seem to figure in your worldview, and so of course you oppose the creation of space for the game. Now, some people, and people sitting very close to me, don't think that was a particularly positive kind of tweet. I don't agree with that, obviously, but I mean, we can talk about that later. I just felt that somebody who was making a really kind of angry tweet about the encroachment of soccer on her space, supposedly her space. It's also my space, by the way. I'm a ratepayer too. But I regret what I did, but only because this person was viciously attacked by a number of trolls. It was really horrible what happened to this person. But I don't regret the content of my statement or the tone in which I said it. Now, she had several gripes. The first was the alienation of parkland. The second was that ratepayers were subsidising a wealthy sporting organisation.
Wealthy
private sporting organisation. That's fair enough. I'm happy to add that. And it was the question of where would the people do park things?
Yes.
It's a park. It's meant to be a park. Where do we do our parking? I'm familiar with the space, and I don't see a lot of people parking down there, I must admit.
Well, if you have a public space that gets deliberately run down and degraded, and then it's like, oh, it's easy for someone to come in and say, well, we'll take over and make it nice.
That's right. Why has it been run down and degraded? I don't even want to argue about that. That's not the issue. I suggested to her that if she understood the history of soccer exclusion from inner city infrastructure and enclosed grounds, her attitude might be somewhat different. And her response to that was, she thought that I was being a kind of defender of Melbourne Victory. And those people who know me know that I'm not a defender of Melbourne Victory and quite antagonistic sometimes.
That is the most ambivalent sort of declaration of antagonism I've ever heard. I'm antagonistic sometimes.
Well, I don't care enough to be fully antagonistic. How does that sound?
That's better.
Okay. So going back in history, though, there are a number of points of contention across Australian soccer history like this. If we go all the way back to Perth in 1906, where we find squabbles over ground. Soccer's trying to get grounds and other codes are trying to get them off. Councils are making arguments. Soccer has a pretty good time of it for a while in Perth, and it's starting to, you know, it wins a lot of battles, aided, of course, by the Pommy school teachers, which are famously criticised in that previous thing on Jervis Bay for a start. But that's the first point in Australian sporting history where this squabble, this struggle for playing space, becomes articulated as a kind of ideological struggle. Before then, it's
just between sports.
Between sports, yeah. And also cultures, because footy sees itself as the Australian game representing proper Australian values, whereas soccer is the foreign game representing, alien values.
But, I mean, this is the thing that happens in Australian society in general, though. Mm-hmm. These things are simultaneous. Yeah. So as you have code battles over space, you also have the other, the parkland people, the free space people, and then the people who want to enclose grounds, whichever code they are.
Yep.
And it just so happens that oftentimes soccer is the last one to get there and doesn't have a sort of a colonizer's kind of privilege.
Yeah. Yes. Well, that's a term you used before, and I really quite liked it, colonizer's privilege. But, the problem is that colonizer's privilege is an invention. And so, you know.
Of course, yes.
And you need to, you know, if you're going to cite your own colonizer's privilege, then there are people who were here before you who are going to say, well, hang on a minute, oh, we want.
Oh, it's an unacknowledged colonizer's privilege.
Yeah.
Or it's not. It's not perceived as sort of infringing on anything because it's the natural way of things.
In Sydney in 1920, there's another piece that I found which really articulates the problem generally across Australian history, and it's a little piece called Soccer. Soccer is a game which is getting a big hold on the Sydney public, but the trouble with which the controlling officials have to contend is the lack of control ground, central grounds. This code of football is wonderfully thrilling to watch when played by first-class teams. Queensland and New South Wales are to meet at Wentworth Oval, and as they played an exceedingly close game in Brisbane, it is fair to assume that enthusiasts will have something special served up in the coming match. So there's a little note about what's going on in Sydney soccer at the time, in interstate soccer, but also the problem of grounds. The problem of grounds is one that's really affecting the game. And so when we look through the history of soccer subsequent to that, there's a whole series of events around Australia: Hobart in the early 20s, Adelaide in the mid 20s, Fitzroy Cricket Ground in 1927, and so on, where every time soccer tries to get a space, there's something pushing back at it.
But there are times where soccer wins,
yes,
even if it's temporarily.
Yeah.
And
well, soccer won in South Hobart in 1923. The locals were saying, we're using all the arguments about don't close it up, what will we all the kids play? But soccer managed to win that one.
And you mentioned Sydney 1920, I think, there's a really interesting book I'm reading now for, and we'll talk maybe a little bit this a bit later, about the Glebe District Rugby League Club from the early 1900s. And the New South Wales Rugby Football League was the ground controller, sort of organised all the grounds for all the different teams, its competitions. And in 1920, they lost access to Wentworth Park because soccer outbid them.
Yeah.
And this is a really interesting thing here. So I'll just read the sort of passage out here. The New South Wales Rugby Football League, concerned about its inability to obtain the use of the oval in Wentworth Park, sought a meeting with the trustees. It was a long and at times acrimonious meeting. Horry Miller set the tone, telling the trustees that we want to negotiate now. Buckle, one of the trustees, responded, suggesting that the league, for some reason or other, does not seem to offer us anything reasonable at all for our ground at any rate. It has not done so in the past. Mm. You all know the price we're getting for the ground now. Lou Abrams, I think one of the other trustees, chided the league delegation. You ought never have lost this ground. You could have had it for a lifetime if you had stuck with us. The rugby union treated us rottenly. They turned dog on us. We were on our uppers and the soccer paid us well. We cannot turn dog on the soccer people after that.
Wow. Yeah. So that was a context in which you come up with the money, you get the ground, which contrasts really interestingly with what happened at Toorak Park in Melbourne in 1954 when JUST turned up to a meeting and offered them 800 quid to rent Toorak Park for a season. And they said, the council actually said, no, we're going to stay with, was it Elsternwick?
Paran.
Oh, no.
Paran Football Club. Elsternwick Oval, was it?
Yeah. It was Toorak Oval. Anyway, it doesn't matter. We're going to stick with the club, the footy club, that pays 25 quid. And when the ratepayers found out that the council, you know, forwent 775 quid, they were furious because that was a hell of a lot of money back then.
And you can see that this works out very differently in different cities, because in Melbourne, for instance, you have a very strong link between councils, local sporting clubs, yeah, especially Australian rules clubs and cricket clubs, and the actual controlling bodies of those sports as well, yeah. Often very much a triangulation of the same kind of incestuous power
network.
And
so soccer is on the edge, yes, always. And so whatever valid objections there are to victory's acquisition, they need to be seen, at least my argument is, they need to be seen in a context of consistent rejection of soccer at these places for whatever reason. It always seems to be a good reason, but it's always also.
But see, my argument would be that there's also a movement, long-standing in Melbourne at least, about keeping open public spaces for the public.
Yeah, and look, I think if I thought that the Victory project was going to be locking up a big area of space, I'd probably change my opinion quite drastically. But I hope that space is always available for the public.
I mean, it comes down to notions as well about what a private business is, because, I mean, Melbourne Victory clearly now is a private business. It's not there to serve an overt public good. Yeah. But in cases like 50 years ago, 60 years ago, where a lot of the ethnic clubs, they weren't private businesses, but because they were professional clubs as well. I mean, that's part of what influences. Well,
let me read this out, Paul. This is from the Albert Park squabble in 1954. I know we're running out of time.
No, it's fine.
And it's a headline in the Argus. Labor must save the parks for children's play. So there's this appeal, this emotional appeal to, won't somebody think of the children? The Labor Party had to fight to preserve Melbourne's inner parklands, Mr. F. McManus, ALP Assistant Secretary, told the opening session of the annual Victorian ALP conference last night. He was replying to criticism of the Labor Party's veto earlier in the year on a proposal to fence a section of Albert Park for soccer matches. The veto was criticised by Senator Kennelly, chairman of the Albert Park Trustees, who said migrants from overseas should have a right to play and attend their own type of football in a minute area of the 688-acre park, where no sport had been refused a ground. Mr. McManus said professional soccer interest, and that's an important point, professional soccer interest, not amateur, which had a great influence and large amounts of money to spend. So here's this rich, apparently, game. And think about the comparisons with the criticisms of the Victory project. Large amounts of money to spend should not have priority over the other sports in the search for playing areas. And I don't think, I mean, this is actually refers to South Melbourne, doesn't it? This
what becomes the South Melbourne?
Yeah, what
Middle
becomes
Park.
South Melbourne? So, you know, I don't think South Melbourne was seeking priority over other sports in the area.
No, I mean,
A home.
But it's a very interesting situation, that one, because Kennelly was a unionist and he was a trustee of the Albert Park, and he gets threatened with disendorsement from the Senate ticket by the unions, and he sort of backs off.
Right.
But about 6 or 7 years later, the ground does get enclosed. Yeah. No one really knows how. There's a government report on it. It's like, we don't really know how it got enclosed.
And late one night.
Yeah, kind of thing. About three quarters of it at one point, and then the rest another day. And Kennelly eventually becomes a senator. Yeah. And I think his son-in-law, who is a Richmond footballer, ends up going on the trust anyway.
Okay.
So Kennelly knows how to work the system, work the game.
All right. Well, I'll just move on. These soccer interests showed no interest in grounds in the outer suburban areas. Well, that's a similar argument being used today. People were saying they should go out to Sunshine. They should go out to St Albans. If the trend of fencing off parkland continues, a ring of enclosed grounds diverted to a single sport would be established on Crown land in industrial areas. Now, if that's not an invasion fear, I don't know what that is. Mr. McManus said once a fence was erected, buildings would arise. Finally, the children from industrial areas would be excluded following claims that sporting property had to be protected. And again, that's an argument that has also been used against the victory. So it's like, the point I want to make is that the arguments being used today against victory are not new arguments. And maybe they're good arguments. Maybe they're good arguments because they're arguments that have been around for a good reason for a long time. But I think we need to understand this process in a historical context and not as just a one-off, really amazing kind of thing that's just happening right now. Come on, stop folding your arms and say something.
No. Look, I mean, you have to think about the parkland itself and what it means for certain suburbs where there's actually very limited parkland. Now, sometimes the councils and ratepayers will try, because they don't actually like soccer.
Yeah.
A lot of times this is the only publicly available land, and especially whether it's 60 years ago or now, the arguments often run along the lines of, this is free. This is something you don't have to pay for to access. It's free whenever you want to use it.
Yeah.
Now, that goes just for as much for the junkies as the children, you know.
Well, I think that's important. And I think that freedom to move across that space and within that space for locals is really important, because I'm a local there, and I would like the idea.
But the same thing happens then. The same arguments made with the Lake Oval and the Junction Oval in Melbourne in Neville Park.
Yeah.
They were supposed to be free access.
Yep.
They weren't really.
Yep.
You know, they were pretty much nominally open to the public, but in reality, they were closed off. And that's what Middle Park happened as well.
Yeah.
It gets fenced off. It gets protected.
Maybe that needs to be something that needs to change in attitudes. But I think we need to stop talking now, and we need to have a little break, or maybe not even have a break.
No break.
Maybe we just need to go straight on to the next.
Just one last thing.
One last thing.
Rugby league is not my specialty.
No.
And normally we wouldn't talk about rugby league too much on this show because, we're in Victoria and we're into proper things. But I've been reading an interesting book called An Act of Bastardry. Rugby League acts as its first club, Glebe District Rugby League Football Club, 1908 to 1929, by Max Solling. And I'm reading that because I'm reviewing it for International Journal on the History of Sport. And there's very little soccer in it, and that's what's the surprising thing, because there are Glebe clubs, and I asked you to look them up, and there's no mention of the Glebe soccer clubs.
Yeah.
And we just mentioned before,
there are Balmain clubs and Roselle clubs and whatever.
Yeah, they exist.
Yeah.
But what's interesting about it and what's useful about reading these kinds of things is you get triangulation.
Yeah.
So you do comparative literature. So you can read your Trevor Thompson book really good, and it's talking about professionalism, right, and the arguments that Australian soccer has within, especially New South Wales, about professionalism, okay, and district boundaries. And maybe Trevor doesn't explain it fully, what that is, but if you read another text like this, you get a much firmer idea of what professionalism means.
Mm.
And it's not necessarily going out full bore and living a living wage as a footballer. It's about just, broken time and, having your expenses paid, for instance. Things like how the different sports competed against each other in terms of evangelicalism, how they went and tried to promote themselves. The nature of the players, who was playing these games. And you've got the Moseley book there, and you've read a bit from there before about the people in the Newcastle Coalfields, for instance, tended to be playing soccer, slightly better off working class.
Yeah, highly skilled tradespeople or experienced miners.
Solid work, consistent work for the most part. Whereas in the rugby league and sort of inner city Sydney, you have most of the labourers of the lowest kind of sort, itinerant, they can get jobs when they're available and nowhere else. Very little middle class participation, except for some administrators. There's things like the Rugby League Ashes. So, have the British teams come over and they compete for the Ashes.
Mm.
So the Ashes becomes as a vernacular kind of thing, as well as, official trophies and so forth. But there's so little soccer in this book that when it appears out of nowhere and all of a sudden, here's soccer, it's been played in Sydney for 35 years. Actually, the author mentions this.
Yeah.
And they've got all this money to buy at Wentworth Park for 3 or 4 years.
Yeah.
It's like, when did this happen?
Which spaceship did this game arrive in?
And this is, it helps to read these things in conjunction with these things.
Yeah.
Because then you get the omissions and the sort of the lacuna of what's going on there.
That's a big word, Paul, lacuna.
Lacuna?
Yeah.
And what does it mean, Ian?
It means like a psychological gap.
And that's what it is.
Yeah.
And we've seen this in similar kinds of work by the Victorian sports historian Mark Fidian, who has these moments where he's a very popular historian in terms of he does a lot of work, not necessarily the highest grade, but he's very prolific.
Well, the hilarious thing is he wrote a book on Brunswick Street Oval where he didn't mention any of the 100 soccer games that had been played at the ground. It was a book about sport on that ground. Until the first mention of soccer was the fact that Heidelberg were in control of the ground when the grandstand burnt down.
But that's the interesting thing, though. I mean, you have to read all the different sources to actually get this information. You've got to triangulate.
Yeah, yeah.
So as much as we're a soccer show and as much as we encourage people to read the soccer books, it is used from time to time, especially looking at specific eras,
absolutely,
to read a book like this.
I mean, Mosley, you know, to talk Mosley up, he does triangulate. He talks about rugby. He talks about rugby league. He even talks about Australian rules, even though it's not all that sort of prominent.
I mean, last week you talked about the Catholic and the Protestant kind of divisions.
Yeah.
And this book here, this Glebe book, is very specific about it's a rugby league is an Irish Catholic game in certain parts of inner Sydney.
Yeah.
And they get into the Catholic school system very early.
Yeah.
And that's a really big thing. I mean, they convince them to play this game.
Yeah.
And maybe that holds back soccer to a degree in Sydney.
Yeah.
Whereas in Melbourne, it makes no influence whatsoever.
Yeah.
All right, is that enough?
I reckon that's enough. We were very quick there. I think I felt like we talked about twice as much as we did last week. Last week we were very relaxed. Today we were very tense because we had so much to get through, and we also disagreed a little bit about a particular issue, which also created a sense of tension. But that's all right. That's the nature of discussion, isn't it, Paul?
Well, the Preston people are outside, I assume.
Yeah, okay. We better go.
We better go. We'll see you next week.
We'll see you next week.
Yeah.